today's case show will be on case 84, Weemaw's The Gate to the One and Only. Engo's introduction. There is nothing right that can truly be called right. There is no wrong that can truly be called wrong. With right and wrong eliminated, gains and losses are forgotten. It's all naked and exposed. Now I want to ask you, what is in front of me and what is behind me? Some monk may come forward and say that in front there are the Buddha hall and the temple gate, and behind the bedroom and the sitting room. Now tell me, is that man open-eyed? If you can see through him, I will acknowledge that you have seen the ancient worthy. Main subject. Weemaw asked Manjushri, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? Manjushri answered, to my mind, in all dharmas, there are no words, no preaching, no talking, no activity of consciousness. It is beyond all questions and answers. That is entering the gate to the one and only. Then Manjushri said to Weemaw, each of us has had his say. Now I ask you, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? Secho says, what did Weemaw say? And again he says, I have seen through him. Secho's verse, you foolish old Weemaw Kitsu, sorrowful for sentient beings. You lie sick in Bialy, your body all withered up. The teacher of the seven Buddhas comes, the room is cleared of everything. You ask for the gate to the one and only. Are you repulsed by Manju's words? No, not repulsed. The golden-haired lion can find you nowhere. Thank you so much for coming to practice today, on this spring day, early summer day. The main subject of the main character in this, or characters in this koan, are Weemaw and Wenshu, or Manjushri. Weemaw is Vimalakirti. There is a sutra specially dedicated to Vimalakirti called the Vimalakirti Sutra. And in Chinese and Japanese, he's known as Weemaw. He was a lay person in the town of Bialy, or Vaishali. In India, and so he was famous for being a very deeply awake person, but still living as a regular lay man. So in his community, Weemaw was a merchant. And he was a successful merchant, and he had a family, and yet he was deeply awake. So Weemaw is sort of the example of a Buddhist practitioner who has been able to integrate his practice into his everyday life. And one of the points of the sutra is that you don't have to be a monk or a nun to achieve that integration. And this is a very important point. In modern East Asia, until quite recently, it's changing now, but in modern East Asia, until quite recently, it was the case that you were a monk or a nun, or you were an ordinary person, And if you were a monk or a nun, you did training, say in meditation and other practices. And if you were an ordinary lay person, you had a job and you raised your kids and you went to the temple. And there was quite a separation between these two worlds. But it's clear that this was not, it's clear from the early records of the Buddha's life that this was not what the Buddha intended. You know, there are some very early sutras which are in Sanskrit called the Agamas, and in Pali, which is an early Indian language that's close to the language the Buddha spoke. In Pali, there's a collection of the Buddha's teachings known as the Pali Sutras, or the Pali Suttas. And there are sometimes also called the Nikayas, which are these collections of early teachings of the Buddha. And scholars have gone through the Nikayas, and they have gone through the life of the Buddha, and they've counted up all the lay men and women who had great awakening experiences, became fully awake. And there were, you know, there were like 35 or 40 of them in the sutras that describe. So, in many places in early Buddhist scriptures, we hear about or we are introduced to deeply awakened lay people. And this was, I think, exactly what the Buddha intended. You know, so the Buddha definitely intended for there to be monks and nuns. He created the order of monks and nuns himself, and he wrote the rules that govern their conduct. So the Buddha intended for there to be monks and nuns, but he also intended for there to be men and women who weren't monks and nuns, who practiced assiduously and achieved awakening, just like our community. So, you know, I think if the Buddha were here today, he would be very happy to see this, right? You know, we all got up, we all have jobs. I have a job, you have a job. Or we're in retirement after many years of working very hard. And you know, you got up this morning, you came here to sit, and many of you come during the week. You have all kinds of demands on your time, but you made time for this to happen. And this is, I think, what the Buddha intended. He wanted there to be monks and nuns, but he also wanted there to be like vigorous practice, vigorous lay practice. And over time, that has tended to disappear. More recently, in places like Taiwan, and especially in Buddhist countries in general, but Taiwan's a good case, also Thailand, a number of other Buddhist countries, and now in mainland China also, you have much more interest in among people who are not monks and nuns in practicing seriously. And I think this is a wonderful development. It's so important. You know, my teacher, Genki Roshi, my first teacher, was a deeply awakened person. And he trained at a monastery in Japan called Ryutakuji, which is near Mishima. And, you know, he had a number of Dharma brothers at his temple, all of whom were deeply awake. And so there was like a line of succession to be abbot of the temple. And in this line of succession, there were like 8 different people who were all deeply awake. And in a certain way, you know, that's kind of a waste of enlightenment, you know. You have these deeply awake people who are just, sitting in a temple somewhere. So, you know, my teacher, Genki Roshi, actually left Ryutakuji, and for a while he went to the Philippines. And he practiced, had a Zen group in the Philippines, but then later he decided to, he went back to Japan for a while, and he met Webb, his friend, and they founded the Seattle Zen Center. He came to Seattle. And this was a wonderful thing because, you know, a very vigorous lay practice began. And in Japan at that time, not many ordinary lay people practiced meditation the way we practice here. If you went to a temple in Japan, you would not see practice more serious than what we do. If you come to one of our sesshins, and I hope you will, sesshin is the essence of Zen practice. You know, if you come to one of our sesshin, you know, you'll see that if you went to Japan, the schedule is no different from our schedule. We sit just as deeply as any temple in Japan. You know, it should be done, and it can be done. And it's happening now all over the Buddhist world. People are rediscovering, I think, what the Buddha intended, which is vigorous lay practice. You know, monks and nuns are like administrators of the Dharma, but the Dharma was created for everybody. You know, monks and nuns are supposed to be accomplished practitioners, but they are also supposed to be leading everybody else in waking up. And sometimes that hasn't happened. So these recent developments are wonderful. And what's happening here in our community is, I think, wonderful too. Really wonderful. We all have busy lives, but we're making a place for this in our life. And the example of this in Buddhism is Vimā, is Vimalakirti, who was also a busy man, had a business, he had employees, he went to work every day, he had a family to feed, and yet, you know, he cultivated a deep enlightenment. In the Vimā Sutra, all the Buddha says to all of his bodhisattvas, please, if you want to understand the fully developed accomplishment of the Dharma, please go to talk to Vimā. Please go to talk to Vimalakirti. So many of his disciples were monks and nuns, and he said, if you really want to understand the full development of the Dharma, please go to see this businessman in Vaishali named Vimalakirti, and he will show you the full development of the Dharma. So this sutra is quite important in the history of Buddhism, and it was a sort of a corrective to this tendency for ordinary lay people not to practice and sort of leaving it to the monks and nuns, which is not good for anybody. So, you know, I really applaud my teacher, Genki Roshi, for leaving his temple, even though it was probably frightening. He'd lived there for most of his life, and coming to a strange city in the United States with, you know, like $100 in his pocket, you know, the equivalent of $100, and starting a new life. But he enriched so many people's lives and created this wonderful community in Seattle, and he's made possible this community too. So this koan involves a conversation between Vimā and Wenshu, or Vimalakirti and Manjushri. Now Manjushri is the bodhisattva of wisdom. You know, on our altar right now, we have a statue of the Buddha, and I'm glad it's there. It's a beautiful statue that was donated to our community by one of our members. Every time I look at it, I think, what a gorgeous statue. In a Zen temple or a Chan temple, there really wouldn't be a statue of the Buddha, believe it or not. The statue of the Buddha would be in the room before you came into the Chan hall. So there'd be a room where you come in, and there'd be a statue of the Buddha, and on one side would be Manjushri, and the other side would be Samantabhadra. But then when you went into the sitting room, there's an altar, and on the altar would be Manjushri. And you can tell Manjushri because he has a sword in his hand. In our, he's riding a tiger, and he has a sword in his hand. And on in our sesshin, we actually have a little statue of Manjushri on the altar, as is the proper way to proper altar for a sesshin. And Manjushri is the bodhisattva of wisdom, and he has a sword in his hand for a reason. Because he's cutting away illusion. So it's the sword, you could say, of mu. When we sit down on the cushion, you know, our minds are full of all kinds of fears and anxieties, all kinds of entrancing thoughts. And, you know, if you sit for a couple sessions and you're calling mu, your mind begins to be liberated from these distractions. You begin to enter this spacious emptiness, which brings you closer to your true nature. And the method of Zen is the method of Manjushri. You know, we cut away at mental formations using mu. This is our method. And so Manjushri is quite important to our practice. He's a symbol of our, you could say, of our method. You know, in the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha says, he who seeks me in form, he who seeks me in language, his footsteps are turned in the wrong direction. So the Buddha says, really, you can't think your way to enlightenment. You know, I'm an English professor, and I love to read poetry. I like plays, and I enjoy novels. But, you know, the truth is, nobody ever broke through to awakening reading a novel. It has never happened in the history of humankind. And I say this as somebody who love poetry. But you just never hear stories of somebody saying, yes, I bought this book of poetry, I came home, and bang, you know, everything was transformed. Suddenly I realize the emptiness of all things, etc., etc. People come home and say, this book of poetry really was wonderful. It transformed my way of thinking about poetry. Right? So our method is to follow the Buddha's advice in the Diamond Sutra. He who seeks me in form, or he who seeks me in language, his footsteps are turned in the wrong direction. That's literally what it says. So we cut away at everything that arises in the mind or in our senses. And this takes us very deeply into the core of our consciousness. And if you keep going through this process of cutting, you drop down more and more deeply through the various layers of your mind. And today, you know, when we were sitting, I'm sure you did that to some degree, especially if you have some pain in your legs, which people have, you know, you want to just sweep it away with your breath, and if you keep cutting the pain sensation away with Manjushri's sword of emptiness, you'll notice at some point that your mind is in a very, very deep place. See, so this is a conversation between these two figures from our tradition, Wima or Vimalakirti, who represents carrying the Dharma into the everyday world. This is so important, right? If the Dharma is locked up in a monastery, it can only do so much good. You know, yes, some people will go to the monastery. But what's really essential in our world is that people who cultivate the Great Way, who cultivate Manjushri's cutting away, are out in the world interacting with other people. And so this is sort of like a conversation between two people who represent different aspects of our practice. You know, Wima is, you could say, worldly engagement of the Dharma. And Manjushri is cultivating awakening by cutting away everything with the sword of emptiness. So Wima asked Manjushri, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? What is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? And Manjushri said, to my mind, in all dharmas there are no words, no preaching, no talking, no activity of consciousness. It is beyond all questions and answers. That is entering the gate to the one and only. Then Manjushri says, my method is to use the sword of Mu to cut away everything. See, he answers very clearly, this is Manjushri, this is what our practice is. There are no words, no preaching, no talking, no activity of consciousness. It is beyond all questions. That is entering the gate to the one and the only. Then Manjushri said to Wima, you know, we've been talking here for a while, and we've both put in our two cents. How would you describe the Bodhisattva gate to the one and only? So we don't get the punchline. The koan doesn't tell us what Wima said. You, obviously, if you're working with this koan, and I hope someday we'll have a chance to do that, you know, you'll have to tell me what he says. Nothing I say here today is going to help you. But I want to make just a few comments about the koan. You know, just to change directions a little bit, I was on the internet killing time the other day. I was waiting for a meeting, and I had all my notes for the meeting, and it was going to take place in my office. So, you know, when I'm in those spaces between one thing and another, and I'm sitting in my office, I go to the Huffington Post, or I read Slate, or one of the other online journals that I like to read, the New York Times. And they had a little story about how Magnum P.I., the television show Magnum P.I., is going to be revived on television. And many of you are too young to remember Magnum P.I. But when I was, let me just say, it was a show about a very handsome private detective in Hawaii. Okay, and he drove a very cool red sports car, and he lived on an estate, the estate of a very famous author in Hawaii. So he lives in this beautiful place, and he's a detective, and it turns out he is an ex-Navy SEAL, and he's working as a private eye, and he sort of rents a little apartment in this luxurious compound, a luxurious compound. And he has adventures. He has a couple of friends from his military experience in Vietnam, and Hawaii is a beautiful backdrop to this. So, you know, I read about this, and when I came home after a sitting on Wednesday night, I told my wife, you won't believe it, but Magnum P.I., they're making a new Magnum P.I., new version of this show. And we both got on the internet to investigate the Magnum P.I. show. And if you're too young, it just doesn't resonate with you, I'm sure. But, you know, we were living in Seattle. We had a very small one-bedroom apartment. Barbara was going to school, and I was going to school at graduate school. And, you know, we lived very, very austere lives, you know. We had a little tiny apartment. We had a little tiny television set. It was, I think the screen was about 12 inches. My neighbor, where I live, I can look out one of the windows in my living room, and I can look into the window of my neighbor, and we're very good friends. And Eddie is his name, and he has a gigantic television. So when I look through my window into his window, I can see against the wall of his living room this gigantic television screen. So television screens have really changed. But when we were in college, in graduate school, we really couldn't afford a TV. So we had this little portable, used to be called a portable TV. And we would take it out once in a while to watch television shows that we liked. And one of the shows we used to watch was Magnum P.I., And it was the adventures of this this bachelor PI, private investigator in Hawaii, and I would come home from sitting at the Seattle Zen Center sometime, and we would watch Magnum PI together, and we loved the show. And when I've looked back at the show now, I realize it's kind of just this silly, corny show. But at the time, our lives were really challenging and difficult, and it was all the things we didn't have in our life, right? Basically, so first of all, we didn't have a cool sports car. We didn't have any car. We used to take the bus. Seattle has a pretty good bus system, and we couldn't have afforded a car anyway. And we didn't live on the Robin Masters estate. This beautiful estate looking over the Pacific Ocean. We lived in a one-bedroom apartment. And we didn't have wonderful adventures that involved, exotic villains and beautiful heroes and heroines. You know, we basically got up every day and went to our jobs or our classes, and came home and typed our papers or worked on our visual arts projects, and we would go to bed and do it the next day. And so watching Magnum was really like pure wonderful escapism for us. It was just this experience of another life that we weren't going to live and couldn't live. Our lives were so different. I remember, Magnum used to wear, on the show, he used to wear a Hawaiian shirt. And the actor who plays Magnum is kind of a very muscular guy, and he looked great in his Hawaiian shirt. And my wife bought me a Hawaiian shirt, but I don't really look like Magnum. I've always been kind of thin and scrawny. So she bought me the shirt, and I put it on, and we both decided I shouldn't wear that shirt. So I actually gave it to her, and she used to wear it, as a little jacket over her other shirt, So, but it was actually a wonderful experience. And when we noticed that it was going to be revived, we were skeptical, like, will they screw it up? It's like the new Star Wars, It's like, are they going to screw this up or not, And we don't have to get into whether they've screwed up Star Wars or not. But we watched the trailer for the new Magnum, and Barbara nodded, like, approvingly. She said, well, they've really got it, So... that's a wonderful aspect of life, right? Sometimes you go to a movie and it's set in an exotic location, or it's involving people who are very different from the people you know. So, another thing I used to do when I was in graduate school was read a lot of detective fiction. I love this writer named Raymond Chandler. If you ever have a chance to kill some time, I recommend you read this writer, Raymond Chandler, who's just this wonderful, wonderful detective novelist. And, he has these mysterious villains and these adventures, and so different from the life I was living as a graduate student. Anyway, it was a wonderful experience, and there's a place for this in life, right? There's a place for this in life. There is a kind of escapism that's just pure fantasy, and it actually makes life richer. You know, it's one of the reasons I like poetry or I like fiction. Or, you know, you go to a museum and you look at beautiful paintings from the south of France. You know, I actually haven't been to most of the places that these paintings depict, but you know, I can imagine what it's like there. That's part of being a human being, and it enriches our lives. But this same tendency that we have to dream of other worlds or seek out, you know, these kinds of satisfactions can become, sort of a problem for us, right? It was great to watch Magnum and then, you know, get up the next day and go to our jobs. And it was kind of cool when my wife bought me the Hawaiian shirt, even though it didn't work out. But, a lot of the time, these things sort of escape from the place in our lives where we put them. And our lives take on the character of constantly wishing we were somebody else, or constantly wishing we were somewhere else. And you see this quite often, actually. You know, I long ago was studying with a teacher in New York State, and he is now deceased, a Zen teacher in New York State. And he had a community up in the Catskills, and when I started sitting with him, one of the things he would do at the end of his session was to have people stand up and give testimonials, which I think are really excruciating and difficult to do and not necessarily great to listen to. So we don't do that here, but at the end of his session, people would stand up and say something about their session experience. And people were, it was voluntary, but, you know, a lot of people would stand up. And one person stood up, and he was an older man, and he said, you know, I came here to this temple 25 years ago when I was a young man, and I did some zazen, and I really enjoyed studying with the Roshi, the teacher here. He said, but then, you know, I got involved in my job, I got married, and I had kids. And now, you know, it's 25 years later, and I've come back. And I was waiting to hear what he would say next. And what he said next was so interesting, because he said, I find myself having very mixed emotions. He said, I really regret not practicing here all the time. I could have been a contender. Everybody just went on to the next guy. But those words really haunted me, because what he basically was saying is, I wish I hadn't gotten my job, gotten married, and had my kids. I wish I had stayed up here at this temple and practiced Zen, and I would be a great Zen master right now, instead of a Zen student beginning all over again. And I was kind of surprised that somebody would. I don't know that people paused to listen to what he said, but it really shocked me. You know, in a way, that mentality is the essence of samsara. In Buddhism, we have two key words. One is nirvana, and one is samsara. And if you think about consciousness as like a spectrum, like the color spectrum, you know, red, orange, green, blue, whatever it is, yellow, violet, you know. At one end is nirvana, and on the other end is samsara. And samsara is like the hell realm, or unhappiness, right? Our unhappiness. And the word samsara means to go around and around in a circle, believe it or not. So this man came to a retreat, he came to a sesshin, he went through the sesshin. At the end of the sesshin, he basically said, I came here 25 years ago, and I'm so sorry I left. I had a job and I had a family, and now I'm back, and I wish I wasn't just an ordinary person. I wish I was a great Zen master. Now, in my opinion, everything he said was showed how deeply unhappy he was with his life, and also why he was so unhappy. You know, I mean, usually when people come to sesshin, you know, especially people from East Asia, at this temple there were a fair number of Japanese people who would come. You know, the Japanese people would usually finish the sesshin, and if they would stand up and speak, they usually said things like this. I am so grateful to the Roshi for having me at the temple, and you know, I'm going to go back to my job, and I'm going to try to be a better worker, or I'm going to go back to my family, and I'm going to try to be a better father and wife, and carry some of this awakened mind into my daily life. And that's sort of, if sesshin is successful, you know, that's sort of how it should go. People encounter this deeper experience of life, and now they're at the end of sesshin, they're going to take that out into the world, and they're going to take it into their lives. And this other person said, you know, basically, I'm leaving sesshin so unhappy that I have to go home and go back to my life. See, so there's something wrong with that person's understanding, not just of Zen, but of life itself, you know. But we all have some aspects of that, right? I think, you know, we all have some aspects of that. So, you know, I have a friend of mine. He's a scholar. And he's done a lot of work. I don't want to give you too much information about him, but he's a professor at Rutgers. And you know, he came to me, and he was very upset. You know, we're friends, and we had lunch together, and it was so clear that he was terribly upset that he had been. He had not been placed on this very special committee. And you know, as we talked, it became so clear that he was just deeply unhappy with who he was and with his life. You know. It was clear from what he said. He looks around at all these other people who have published more books than he has, or who are more famous than he is in their fields, you know. And he's just, it's like he was so unhappy being in his own life. And I think all of us have this is possible for all of us at certain times, right? I mean, we all have this tendency to fantasize, right? We all have our magnum PI, you know, whatever it is. But this ability to imagine ourselves in another life is, like, wonderful in some ways, but in other ways, it's actually kind of like poison for us, right? Part of Zen practice is learning to stop doing that, right? You know, one of the good things about Zen practice is when you sit down on the cushion and you go into deep mushin, everything disappears. You know, and if you do this long enough, if you're at a sesshin, for example, you know, around day three, very ordinary things that you took for granted suddenly seem very beautiful and very alive. You know, so on day one of sesshin, you know, when the rice comes, it's just rice. On day two of sesshin, it's just rice. You know, on day three of sesshin, you can look down in your bowl and you just feel, you know, this is how wonderful to eat this rice. You know, there was a very famous Zen master named Soen Roshi, Soen Nakagawa Roshi, who was basically in the same lineage as my first teacher. He also used to be at Ryutakuji in Mishima. But Genki Roshi was telling me, he said, you know, Soen Roshi is a deeply awakened person. And Soen Roshi said that at one sesshin, he looked over when they were reciting the meal sutra. And the rice was being passed, and when Soen Roshi put rice in his bowl, Genki Roshi said tears were running down his face. I actually believe that. You know, on day three of sesshin, you know, everything comes alive. You know, rice in a bowl is so wonderful. You know, on day one of sesshin, you might never even notice the flowers around the building, but on day three of sesshin, you know, these flowers are the most precious thing on earth, right? So we all have sort of that mentality of wishing we were somewhere else or wishing we were someone else. You know, and our culture encourages that to such an extraordinary degree. You know, I don't want to get too political, but, you know, so much of our culture is based upon creating envy. It really is, if you begin to look around. You know, even things like the latest fashions, right? I mean, and again, fashion, dressing up, I like to dress up too. You know, I just got a new tie. It's a cool new tie. I wore it to a meeting. People said, wow, what a tie, you know? So I'm not against ties, or I'm not against beautiful clothes. You know, I'm not against that. But you know, so much of our culture works to create envy and a sense of, you know, one-upmanship. Like I'm not as good. You know, I'm not as good as you. I don't drive around in a Miata. I drive around in an old Honda. You know, and some of our consumer culture is based on creating envy. You know, so. When I used to have a phone, I don't have a phone anymore, but I used to have a flip phone, and I would be in social gatherings, and people would take out their phones. I'd take out their flip phone, and they'd look at me like I was, you know, like from the 1920s or something, you know. And I would just laugh because I actually don't care, but you know, definitely there's among my students, there's definitely competitiveness about the kinds of phones they have, right? And I think the iPhone is like the top of the food chain. So if you have an iPhone, you're cool. If you have an Android, you're less cool. And there are other even less cool phones, right? So our culture encourages people, you know, to want to be someone else, including, you know, sometimes by getting what they have, getting their clothes or their phones or living another person's life. And this is the essence of samsara. You know, nirvana is being here now 100%. You know, being here now 100%. You know, if you want to know what enlightenment feels like Daikensho, it feels like the deepest sense of gratitude you have ever experienced. You know, if you think about it, we don't always experience gratitude. You know, we experience satisfaction, we experience happiness, you know. But gratitude, you know, that's a rather rare response to things, don't you think? You know, but gratitude is really not dependent on anything in particular. It's something we have in ourselves. You know, deeply awakened people live a life of constant gratitude. And I think that's what Soen Roshi was overcome by when he was eating that rice, when the rice was served to him. It's like, you know, in some Zen communities they say, we don't say this, but in some they recite sutras to say, 1,000 labors brought us this food. You know, every time we eat a bowl of rice, think of all the people and all the hours of their lives that were required to produce that rice, so that all those people worked. You know, actually, growing rice is mostly done by machine, but it's back-breaking work. You know, and people, you know, basically spent their whole lives producing rice. You know, so when we're eating rice, you know, gratitude is an appropriate emotion, but when we rarely feel, and you can't really make yourself feel gratitude. It's like when I was young, my parents would try to get, there was a famine in Africa, it was a region called Biafra. And my mother would try to get me to eat my food, and she'd say, think of those Biafran refugees, right? And that did not make the food more appetizing. So you know, that doesn't really work. You know, how do we live the life of gratitude? Well, we live the life, you know, Manjushri knows the secret to the life of gratitude. You know, it's just what we're doing on the cushion. We're cutting away at all of our illusions. You know, you sit down on the cushion and you cut, and when you get up, the world is a little cleaner, a little more present. The boundary between yourself and the world has dissolved a little bit. And, you know, if you continue to sit, if we were to do this for a couple of days, you know, around day three, that boundary is almost gone. And when you feel that deep sense of connection, you realize, you know, you're just where you should be. Wherever you happen to be, that's just where you should be. There, you know, we look around at other people and say, if only I were there. If only I were there and not here. But that is the essence of samsara. That is the essence of unhappiness, right? You know, we are exactly, you know, we all think we make decisions in life, but actually we generally make the best decisions we can make. And we don't all have equal opportunities, right? So you know, I got this job at Rutgers, which I've been doing for 30 years, on a fluke. You know, I just happened to see the advertisement for the job at Rutgers. I almost didn't go to the interview because I thought Rutgers was too good a school to give me a job. Really, I actually almost didn't go. I thought, oh, the Rutgers, you know, they'll never hire me. And then I went to the interview, and they actually said, you know, please send us an article. And I didn't send it because I didn't think they were serious. I got a call from the chairman of the department. He says, where's that goddamn article? And I said, you really want it? He said, what are you talking about? That really happened. I swear to you. He said, what are you, we're waiting for your article. So I sent it. It just chanced, though. You know, if I hadn't gone through that door, if I hadn't seen that article, I wouldn't have this wonderful job. I don't know what I'd be doing right now. So a lot of life is chance. You know, we don't control everything. And we do our best. You know, sometimes life doesn't work the way we want it to work. But, you know, it's always 100% Buddha nature. It's always 100% Buddha nature. See? And that is the road to happiness. It's not just the road to awakening. It's the road to happiness.
That
There is nothing right that can truly be called right. Ango, introduction. There is no wrong that can truly be called wrong. With right and wrong eliminated, see, good and bad, right and wrong, gains and losses are forgotten. Now it is all naked and exposed. Some monk may come forward and say that in front there are the Buddha hall and the temple gate, and behind the bedroom and the single room. Tell me, is that man open-eyed? He's looking back, looking forward. What's happening here? You can see, if you can see through him, I will acknowledge that you have seen the ancient worthy. Main subject, Vima asked Manjushri, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? Manjushri answered, to my mind, in all dharmas there are no words, no preaching, no talking, no activity of consciousness. It is beyond all questions and answers. That is entering the gate to the one and only. Then Manjushri said to Vima, we've been talking here for a while, what is your view of the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? Secho says, what did Vima say? And again he says, I have seen through him. So we don't know. Secho's verse, you foolish old Vima Kitsu, sorrowful for sentient beings, you lie sick in Bialy, your body all withered up. When Vimalakirti actually was ill, he suffered an illness like everybody else. And when he was ill, the Buddha came to see him. See, even in his ill, gravely ill. Manjushri lives the life of gratitude. You lie sick in Vaishali, your body all withered up. The teacher of the seven Buddhas comes. The room is cleared of everything. You ask only for the gate to the one and only. Are you repulsed by Manju's words? No, not repulsed. The golden-haired lion can find you nowhere. In other words, you're completely free from obstacles. You live the life of gratitude.